Thank you, George. I want to thank all the organizers and all your guys here for the chance to talk about Samara Hackathon. I did not expect so many questions I got when I came. Everybody want to, I would say torture me, but at least want me to answer some questions. All right. In my talk, I think it will be more constructive to present what I have seen, have learned from many colleagues, for some of you guys here, about Samara Hackathon, and present the way I approach a problem, and how I designed the solution, and what we saw. And if you really want to ask me questions, I may in the end make some comments about other groups' works. All right. Okay, so for my talk, I'll focus on Samara Hackathon and talking about two-dimensional Fermi surfaces there. The main tool is quantum oscillation using magnetization or magnetic torque. And here is a major one data file where we look at magnetic torque versus magnetic field, seeing the first order quadratic curves and then wiggles on top of that. The Fourier transform confirmed there's periodic structures involved H, which means there's quantum oscillations, or more practical, the term is there has an alpha effect. And to us, the most exciting part is the location of these peaks follows Wall cosine angle line, which suggests we have a 2D, at least a quasi-2D Fermi surface. Means either it's a plane or it's at least a cylinder. All right, so this is basically the result I'm going to talk about. All right, before I go, I want to thank all the collaborators, my colleagues in Michigan, and all the wonderful groups supporting us samples and all the helps. All the data we're taking in Magnet Lab in Tallahassee, Florida, and major support comes from DOE and a few other agents. And all the majority of work was done by postdoc Gang Li. He's on market. He's on market for a few years. So if you have a job, he's a great guy. Okay, so here's my outline. Okay, we look at a ball sample. We look at a sample that's quite different from typical compounds these days. Always people looking at the layer structures like cuprates, like bismuth selenide, where you have clear anisotropy. In this case, we do not. The crystal structure is a cubic, very nice cubic. I'll talk about detail about what this really means. But the sample, if you look at, it's such a nice crystal. You not only see the top, bottom, edge surfaces, you also observe the facets that's 45 degrees away from the top planes. And you see these facets. It's a very nice crystal. And this particular one comes from Zach Fields' group, and we took a picture. Okay, so we try to look at what happens in quantum oscillation, but of course, you wonder why. I mean, this is no insulator. Why would I ever want to look at quantum oscillations there? So I will try to give you a short introduction about the field and how we did experiments. We know the need there, and we know it's a quite a challenging experiment, so we won't discuss how. And the main results, and I will focus on why we believe it's two-dimensional in the sense I'm going to work with you together step by step by tracking the angular dependence and try to show you how we approach that, understand the angular dependence, and how we conclude it's two-dimensional. Okay, I'm probably going to skip along the lab index plot. There's some preliminary evidence we have suggesting at least some pockets we believe it's Dirac-like, but we need much stronger field to conclude all the pockets are Dirac-like. And I'm going to present, since there are progress from the Cambridge group, talking about the samples made by floating room method and so-called floating zone samples. There's something interesting going on there. I want to present how we observe, and something really unique there. The mass gets much stronger, much larger there. Okay.
So yes. Did you say how your samples were made? Were they also floating zone or?
Oh yeah, yeah, good. Zach sample is flux method. Yeah. Majority samples, I have measured about 20 samples. All these 20 samples are flux grown samples. And one or two compounds we got from my friend Tara McQueen from Johns Hopkins. based where that's what the colleague, and that's the floating zone sample. I want to show the contrast, but I want the main focus on the similarity between this guy and that compound. All right. Okay, so Samara Hexborough, I guess, after last Friday, I don't have to see much. But basically, to me, I look at the resistivity curve, it's almost insulated. As you can see, it's a well-studied compound almost 50 years since the discovery insulating behavior. And this is just one curve we measure, try to measure on one plane by putting Corbino ring on that. We look at from 30 Kelvin to 3 Kelvin, we have almost three orders of magnitude change of resistivity, old resistance, if you like. But below very low, below 3 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin, resistance saturates. That's the dilemma. Looking at this, I would think I have a piece of insulator, at least a semiconductor. Gap could be small, but going approaching ground state, I would expect no conductor at all. But we see some finite conductance, kilo-ohm range, lying below the quantum resistance, and what's happening there? Okay, there's a lot of theory, and there's a lot of debates, a lot of experiments, interesting discussing about that. About the insulating behavior, I think people agree that it's a mixed valent compounds, in the sense you would have a valence sitting not at 2, not at 3, but rather in middle. And in that sense, the D states or D bands sits across right and F bands, and there will be hybridization, and there will be a small gap opening. And that gives the insulating behavior.
Can you show magnetic susceptibility data, or just draw by heart?
Would you say again?
Squid magnetic susceptibility data as comes from temperature for this material.
Oh, right. Magnetic susceptibility data is Curie-wise like, basically.
Yeah,
I
mean, just go.
Okay.
Well, it will saturate at low temperature.
Well, it's, okay. You can say it's saturated. You can, actually, people claim there is a spin gap behavior there. And very low temperature.
Okay.
I don't remember. Sorry, I did not measure the squid measurement on this particular compound. Even though I tried to present your magnetization, I was rather looking for anisotropy in the magnetic ability. Yeah. To back your question, I do not exactly know what happens, particularly below 10 Kelvin there. But I believe by fitting this line, they argue that there's certain valence and mixed valence states in high temperature.
Yeah, but it was saturated below the condom temperature, it's around 50 Kelvin.
Oh, good
to
know.
So the saturation behavior already appears at around the 50 Kelvin. You can see that.
Actually, long ago, we measured ESR, in this material, we put some few percent of gadolinium, and below 140 K, it goes like BCS, skin gap is open.
Yeah,
really?
So even higher, so,
it goes exponentially.
So you're saying you put some magnetic doping there, it goes like that?
Not to say I'm talking about dynamic susceptibility.
Okay, but dynamics...
I saturate, I believe. I forgot this word.
Oh. That's very interesting. Well, today I'm going to present only pure sample data, right? But we have try to dope that with the collaborators and see what's going on and what's the fate of the quantum oscillation. There's something really interesting going on there, so I'd like to learn from you about what happens with the doping. Okay. All right. So about where the plateau or where's the saturation resistance comes from, and there's a lot of debate. And quite recently, there's a theory coming from the collaboration, one is my colleague Kai Sun, and from Pierce, from Victor, and from Maximil. They were suggesting maybe that the ground state could be a topological insulating ground state. In the sense, they have a certain mapping that to map this correlated system into a single band system, and they find out there's a band inversion, and they argue that there's a topological protected surface states. So if that's true, that's robust for attack surface days, that's a reason why you will see some finite resistance at low temperature. And if that's the case, we would have insulating bulk, Dirac cones, and helical spin structure. There's a lot of interest going on comparable to Bismuth alumina. Well, that's the theory, right?
I'm a bit confused. When you say that, so something is topological insulator, a material has topological insulator band structure, doesn't mean it's insulating the bulk, right? That doesn't follow from that.
It may not be exactly insulator just by saying that you need to look at where can potential sits.
Right. But if I consider this one band picture or whatever the best understanding of band structure is, for getting quantum insulator you require that the number of conduction electrons is the same as number of F electrons. They have to be exactly equal. So is there any reason, stoichiometric reason that they have? Otherwise, you can never get insulated by on the general grounds.
Sorry, I don't get your question. Could you say it again?
For getting a quantum insulator, mm-hmm. it's a requirement based on very general argument. So the number of conduction electrons, or say number of d electrons in some single band picture, should be equal to number of f electrons. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, if there's any kind of mismatch, you will always left with some hole pocket or anything in the bulk. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way to get insulator otherwise. So do we know something about the ratio of?
You usually ask the wrong person for that. Okay. Rather, probably photo emission guys will tell you the exact story about where the band sits and what's the ratio between different carriers. That's something really interesting to interesting question, and I'm probably not the right person to answer that. Particularly, this is mixed valence state.
Right.
So again, I'm not the right person to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so maybe I can answer your question. So in this scenario has a boride, so the charge transfer process is not, the 4F electron, there's less 4F electron if you compare the 2 plus situation. The 4F electron not transfer to the P electron, to the D electron.
Mm-hmm. So those numbers are not separately concerned, right? So you cannot define the number of d electrons and f electrons.
But in some loose way you can define that. Once you have some well-defined Wiener function, then you can always define that. Number of d electron and the number of the f electron. So they are actually transfer between the f to d. Mm-hmm. So before transfer, before charge transfer, the 4F electron is the 5 half shell is completely full. Mm-hmm. So once you transfer electron, and the D electron is completely empty. 5D empty. So because this D band dispersion is big enough, is deep enough, so it generates charge transfer from 4F orbital to 5D orbital. Mm-hmm. So this so as long as there's no charge transfer from 4F to 2P, so this conduction band electron number and the valence band electron number, they are exactly equal to each other.
In other words, it's semi-metal with equal number of electrons and holes at high temperature.
Right.
And this semi-metal comes insulated low temperature, below 150.
Yeah, that's correct.
Well, again, just from experimental evidence, we know it's insulator. But still, I have to reconcile the picture that it's a semi-metal at high temperature, insulator and low temperature, and how would we understand the valence changes from 2.8 to 2.6 as you cool down the sample. Right, there's something interesting going on there.
Yeah, that's from purely a band structure, point of view. Of course, it's a very strong Coulomb-Poisson interaction.
Right. Actually, I just realized because the valence is only 2.6, so the underlying Fermi structure, even possible if magnetic breakdown happens, then it cannot be like lithium hexafluoride, because the valence there is 3. So the underlying Fermi surface will be very different. Even if your 5 Tesla can break, if you imagine 5 Tesla can break the gap. All right, anyway, okay.
I was just saying that even if they are not separately conserved, some has to be integer to get into.
Right.
That's
yeah. the summation of the F and D electrons, they are conserved.
Okay, good. All right. I really enjoyed the discussion here. Maybe we don't have to go much in the detail of discussion. Okay. Well, I enjoyed the discussion with theorists, and we know that, well, I came from a qubit background, right? Wherever there's a hot discussion with theorists, probably we don't have to follow that. For qubits, in the sense that typically it's observation happening first, right? And then theorists would predict or post-predict any new theory about to explain that. But I was really amazed for topological materials. Theorists always lead. Who can imagine this can be demonstrated in a few years? But indeed, my colleague Charlene Kerdek, and he led a collaboration, try to look at the non-local transport for a 3D insulator. Well, for non-local measurements, it's quite, for quantum Hall effects, it's quite easy to understand, in the sense, if this is a whole bar, you look at the current going there, you look at the voltage drop on the edge states, right? But you can still get a current this way and try to find out what happened far, far, far away. And if indeed there's edge channel, you're going to see a similar voltage drop there. So similar idea happened for the surface conductance for topological insulator. If you're able to design kind of leads configuration, you may see different drops or different profile resistance. Okay. To understand exact profile of the data is, well, to me, it involves at least a lot of modeling. But one thing occurred to me that's very striking in the following sense. This find out the resistance profile versus temperature in different leads configuration shows a quite difference in terms of temperature dependence. Above that saturation temperature, it's almost on top of each other. By on top of each other, I mean it can be scaled with the geometrical factor. But below that transition temperature, it's either monotonic going up or there's a non-monotonic behavior. So you cannot really, for the whole temperature range, you cannot scale the whole thing in one geometric factor. Well, as experimentalists, I know typically when we measure something with a bulk resistance, well-defined bulk resistance, we can measure different values in different leap configurations. There's always a geometrical factor there. But typically, you can have that R versus T profile in many, many different configurations, and you're laid on top of each other with just a scaling factor because the resistivity, bulk resistivity matters there. In this case, it shows that there must be a quite strong anisotropic contribution happening below that saturation.
Can you say which curve is which configuration of these?
You know what? I have to really read their papers to understand that. You see that they have something going this side, that side, or going this way, and try to measure profile there. You know what? They design something, they have to understand their figures with certain modeling. So I'm not very comfortable defining that modeling, but the anisotropy is really well defined. Okay, and similarly, the Irvine group demonstrated similar anisotropy by such a clever design. They have a wedge sample and try to find out how the whole signal scales with that thickness. And same time, this all the three have papers happening within a week. And the Maryland group led by JP showed that there's a certain kind of bulk tunneling gap there. All right, so this is within months, I believe. So Xi Dai posted this paper, and the group calculated the band structure, demonstrating there might be a gap, and there a projected surface state. So what the prediction would be, that there will be on the 100 plane, there will be three Dirac cones, one area in the center, and the other would have the same area. So if we're able to measure Fermi surface areas, we're going to expect two Fermi surface areas out of 100 planes. Okay.
Are some hole-like and some electron-like?
From this picture, I guess, even from this picture, it's hard to say whether it's hole-like or electron-like, because you do not know where the can potential sits. And I believe our data, as well as photo emission data, demonstrate this picture may not be precise. means the dipole may be deep in the valence band.
The initial people, they know where they can
potential,
yeah. Yeah, but this the position of the dipole comb is very very difficult to get it right, because we didn't do surface charge self consistent, which is very very difficult to do, because we have to do the not ordinary DFT calculation, but LD per Schutzwiller. And you have to take care of this complicated coolant repulsive interaction. So that's why it's, we can only do it at the attack binding level for the surface calculation. Yeah.
Okay, so that's a story I learned before. I learned about Simon Hexborer. I learned about this interest in progress, and I'm thinking about if indeed there is a protected surface space, how would we see that? From what people have done in conventional topological insulator like Bissing Serena, photo emission would be one way to demonstrate the direct dispersion, and particularly interest in helical spin structure. STM look at the surface states right away. Quantum oscillations can also tell us a lot. Okay, well, by the way, for Simon Hexborer, there's tons of papers. I don't think this is a complete list for the photo emission, for the STM. Quantum oscillations, at some point, we're the only group posted something online. I'm happy that and learn. The Cambridge group got a paper out, and I believe Jin Xia also has some nice results, even though he's not posted yet. Okay, all right, let me try to explain what we can see by quantum oscillations. And of course, later we can discuss what's the difference we observe between different groups. All right, so what quantum oscillation can tell us? Very first is dimensionality. Why? Well, quantum oscillation is determined by magnetic field, right? If it's indeed that there is a flat surface space, then there should be a big perpendicular which determines the quantum oscillations. Frequency should scale with what we call an angle. That would tell us there's a two-dimensional surface state, or at least two-dimensional electronic state. By two-dimensional, I mean it's either a sheet or at least it's a shell cylinder. It could be a circle or it could be a cylinder. All right, so this is such a thing has been demonstrated by many, many experiments. In this particular one, this is from Jan Fischer's group, where he looked at bismuth selenide. He found out that all the oscillation patterns scale as one big perpendicular. All right, so the other signature, this mainly comes from the one who discovered quantum Hall effects from graphene. And in this particular example from Philip Kim's group, where they look at the lambda lab index and plot and find out where the high field limit would be, and they find out if there's a half integer there. Half integer comes from the fact that there's the Dirac point, so the last lowest lambda level is split in half, half into one half into the conduction band, one half into the valence band. And they were able to demonstrate that half integer and show there's indeed interesting barrier phase there to show its direct dispersion. And such a thing is also demonstrated in topological insulators, even though the criteria about how to define the field value for lambda levels is, there's a lot of controversy there, and I believe it's settled by the or by Poin's group, where you're able to demonstrate how to look at the conduction tensor or conductivity tensor to find out locations of each level and really demonstrate it's one half. All right, so I know what you need to do, at least from typical transport or thermodynamic measurements, to show it's a topological protected surface state. Well, it's really challenging. I think not just my group, there are many groups try to do electrical transport measurements going to the highest field we can available, 45 Tesla DC fields there. And the result is not very conclusive. Here is a 2D resistance versus field. And here's a derivative of that. And taking the Fourier transform here, I would not be confident to say there's any peaks. That might be just buried in this noise. Okay, well, so to us, life is really hard. But if you guys, an experimentalist there, know that life is always like this, it always sucks, you know that. You think about you have the best sample, you have best field, well, nothing happens. Result is always negative, but you can think about something else, right? Electrotransport, unfortunately, did not reveal any conclusive evidence. Maybe we can look at thermodynamics. Maybe we can look at the magnetization, which is a derivative dFdH, which means it's very sensitive to density state change. If we're able to measure the magnetization, we should be able to detect something if there's indeed a lambda level quantization. Well, I tried that because before I did some experiments on bismuth. I happen to know that magnetization measurement, particularly torque magnetometry measurements, is the very first demonstration of Fermi surface, well, in single crystal bismuth. This is by Schoenberg himself. Okay, so maybe we can try to measure the magnetization whole thing. And if it's indeed from surface states, maybe they're going to give us some wiggles in high fields. But the very natural question is that to be first, do you have a bulk tool, which is magnetization, right? That's sensitive to a 2D layer, to the surface. Volume is really small. Do you have enough resolution? Well, that's challenging, but maybe we can try. In a sense, if there are some spins or some moments sitting on the surface planes, we apply some field, there will be a torque, M plus H, which is going to deflect the sample. So if we put that on a floppy cantilever, apply some field, there will be some deflection, and from deflection we know the torque, and we can get the effective magnetization back, taking the ratio torque and H and some other factors like angle. But one thing I want to emphasize, right? Here I try to measure magnetic torque, which means I'm measuring the cross product of M and H. If M and H are this parallel and parallel, nothing happens. Or if sample A is completely isotropic, I should not have any signal at all. So in that sense, this tool is really sensitive to magnetic anisotropy. There's an angle, there's a signal. No angle between M and H, there's nothing. Maybe this favors surface state because 2D, by definition, it's a very anisotropic. But who knows? Let's look at the data.
Any sample, you always have some torque.
Because effectively, you are able to have some shape anisotropy there.
Sure.
At least.
Particularly,
yes. Right. And one other thing that is many measurements effectively create some gradient in the magnet. So there will be some signal. May not be torque itself, but could come from the force. It also happens. Right? So that's the thing we need to, at least in our group, we're able to generate some magnetic field gradient to verify this is coming from torque or this is coming from force itself. That's a very good point.
Crystal structures cubic?
True. It's very nice. It's the only compound I ever studied at cubic. Well, point out that there might be some built-in intrinsic, even though it's bulk space, there might be something intrinsic and anisotropy there to give you a talk. But it may not be exact quadratic, because different anisotropy may not be different, like easy plan or easy axis give you a quadratic contribution. Rather, it could be something really complicated. But I try to say that overall, the majority of susceptibility is isotropic, which means torque should not pick it up.
Yeah, linear susceptibility is isotropic.
Yes, that's not right. Yeah. All right, so that's the setup and that's a cartoon. And this is a piece of setup. This is a very old picture. I believe when I was still student of Quan. We have a floppy cantilever sitting on a certain kind of substrate. The main thing is that cantilever forms a gap between the cantilever and the gold field underneath. So there is a gap, and in between it's either vacuum or helium-3. Okay. So anyway, it's a capacitor, and we're able to resolve this capacitance to 1 ppm level, so part a million, and basically that translates to this is typically 100 micron. So part of a million there means we are able to resolve something nanometer, some nanometer level change. And that translates to, well, a number of resolution values there. I know for many theorists, even for experimentalists there, it does not make much sense for these members, like how many Bohr magnetons we have overall. But one thing I can compare is following, right? I know how many unit cells per surface unit cell, just layer there for typical samples we have there. And if we count all the surface unit cells, we roughly have 10 to 14 union cells. And that resolution translates to 10 minus 4 Bohr magneton per surface union cell. But this is assuming only surface contributes, right? If we're assuming that everything contributes, our resolution is way better. Okay, anyway. I'm trying to say that this resolution is good enough to measure the magnetic oscillations for 2D layers. Okay, and you can see that I have, this is something about our setup. And I have the demonstration, I have a picture here. You can see it's really, it's kind of small. The size I put, for the size, I put a piece of paper there. So you see it's a few millimeter and at least a half a centimeter long. So that's the typical size. So it's easy to carry, easy to adapt. I also put a paper there to show how cheap we are. We'll just make tons of that. I train every student, every undergrad student in my group making this. So they can tailor their cantilevers to fit different needs. In this particular case, right, this is actually single crystal bismuth. It's relatively large, so we need something relatively stiff. For some other much smaller samples that needs probably 100 micron, even smaller, we are going to have much softer cantilevers. So we are tailoring the whole thing and going to different facilities. And here I called going to 45 Tesla. Actually, we are able to get to 60 Tesla using pulse field in Tallahassee. I'm sorry, in Los Alamos, but we have to redesign the whole thing because there's also a damping thing, and particularly eddy current contributions, make sure we can take care of it by replacing this with the insulator. All right, so for this particular study, we have our own dual freight in our lab in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and we want to use the hybrid magnet in Tallahassee. All right, so that's something about setup, and I want to show you some, what do you expect, right? So if it's a paramagnet, I'm going to be linear with H, so it's going to be a straight line. For the torque, if it's anisotropic, for the torque, what you're going to see, so it'll be product or cross product of the M and H. So we're going to see a quadratic dependence. It turns out for most of the samples, we're going to see the quadratic dependence, at least at low fields, right, without quantum oscillation. Once quantum oscillation happens, you are going to see wiggles. This is a very famous work by Eisenstein this is 30 years ago, dumped on the 2D electron gas. And they were able to see the wiggles from the lambda level quantization. That's very often, in fact, for a superlattice and a hyperstructure. This was a later work from a different group in French, where they were able to measure the torque or magnetization versus the filling factors, the no filling factors, by measuring the whole conduction in situ. So the same sample, same condition, they measure both. So this is a filling factor increase, and that means the B increases that way. As you can see, there's each levels, lambda levels, right? And between each levels, we see the magnetization swaying by Bohr magneton per each level, two Bohr magnetons, roughly speaking. And that's consistent from what you expect from a theory, from simple calculation for diamagnetic currents for 2D electron system. And so two Bohr magnetons is roughly what we're looking for. Remember, I told you that the resolution is roughly 10 minus 4 Bohr magneton per surface unit cell. So that means if it's indeed oscillations, we're able to pick it up. And more importantly, what we see, we have a B field this way, and each lambda level crossing, we see a swing going from positive to negative M. And that swing tells us where we should look for in magnetization to look at each lambda level. So M should drop sharply, or the derivative dm dh should show sharp minimum at that position. So that's the criteria we're going to need to define where lambda level is. All right, so again, from oscillation to the electron, we know that for surface state, we're going to expect this oscillation fluxes should be roughly 1 hour cosine angle. So that's the main thing we're going to check. By the way, we're going to look at this. Okay, good. So I spent 30 minutes talking about how we did the experiments. Let's work together and look at the results. Right. Again, this is a cubic compound. Here, this small atom there is boron. So six boron and four make a cluster, and that's sitting in the center of this cubic lattice. And there's A side, which is similar there. So that's B side. As you can see, this is simply AB-AB lattice. It's a very good cubic structure. And as a result, sample is quite isotropic in the bottom. Okay. All right, so again, this is a picture. We took a picture from very top, so we have top planes and then edge facets. Okay, so this is a view going from top. Now, let me try to take a view from this side. And what I mean by that, I see if we look from the side, and there's a top plane, bottom planes, edge planes, coming from 100 family. And there's facets that's 45 degrees away. Okay, all these eight planes, as I'm going to sweep the magnetic field and rotate the field in this plane. So in this plane, and it turns out all these planes will contribute to the quantum oscillation signals. And I'm going to work with you together based on this and based on the data and show you that. All right. So that's the sample. And here's an example of data where we look at magnetic torque versus the field. And this is absolute unit of magnetic torque. Low fields is quadratic. So as expected, it's a paramagnet. So there's a signal there. And about roughly 5 Tesla, we start to see the wiggles, the slow wiggles, and some fast wiggles. So from the data right away, we know we're going to have at least 2 frequencies just by looking at the raw data. Now this is a torque. We take torque over H, and we get a magnetization there. So this was taken up to 45 Tesla, and this is taken at 300 millikelvin. So what do we observe here? At low fields, it's roughly linear, so it's paramagnetic. Again, in high fields, we see all these wiggles, right? We see a slow wiggle, and we see some fast wiggles. Each wiggle was absolute value telling us about units. So roughly speaking, good changes by 10 to minus 12 meters squared. Again, I know this does not make much sense. Let me try to scale that with something else, right? So imagine we have how many unit cells we have exactly on the surface. And this bar is roughly 0.5 Bohr magnet per surface unit cell, which means it's each swing here, roughly half of that, so in that order, 0.2, 0.3 Bohr magnet per surface unit cell. So that's a signal strength. It's actually a very small signal, right? Because here we're just looking at counting that by surface unit cell. But again, we do not know exactly where it's coming from by just looking at that. So imagine such a signal is just coming from the bulk. We should have not roughly 10 to 14 unit cells, but rather it should be rather 10 to 20 to 10 to 21 unit cells. So this normalized by number of unit cells in the bulk, this is roughly 10 to minus 7 Bohr magneton per unit cell. So that's the strength of signal. Please bear that in mind, because if we want to think the signal, this dominating signal comes from bulk, that's at least value we want to keep in mind for the community. Because I believe the other group, the Cambridge group, did a wonderful study showing the dominating features, but unfortunately, they did not present absolute unit. So if indeed the dominant feature is comparable to ours, so it's roughly 10 minus 7 Bohr magnet per surface units, per bulk unit zone. All right. Okay, so this is something we should, I'll just skip that. But let me see that, right? We have this fast oscillation. We even have the beating oscillations. So what we are going to figure out frequencies, well, we're going to take Fourier transform of the oscillation pattern versus 1 of h, and here's what we see. There's a slow oscillation, there's a fast oscillation, there's another dominating peak, which tells us it's indeed beating, right? We can see there's beating for the fast oscillations. So these three are dominating frequencies we observe. We see the harmonics of the dominant one, so the beta, we have 2 beta or 3 beta. We even see some other feature, some other beta. Turns out, later I'm going to show you, it's coming from neighboring planes. I'm going to explain where it's coming from. It's simply coming from the same geometry of the cubic sample. Okay, so this is a basic Fourier transform of that. And I will also show that same data set, we look at up to 20 kilo Tesla. We have almost nothing. This is our data. Given the noise floor, I will see that above 2 kilo Tesla, I don't see much signal. This is alum flux ground samples. I did not observe anything particularly interesting in there. Okay, all right, so we see some signal. Now let's come to the key conclusion, right? We believe it's two-dimensional. And how do we do that? We have done many, many angles. There are just two samples coming from 20 samples we studied. What we did there, we tried to rotate the magnetic field every 8 or 10 degrees, covering a broad temperature range as possible as we can, given what can be allowed in magnet lab, and cover some different cool down to build up statistics. As you can see, I tried to label all this, even harmonics there. I know it's very dense, so hard to see. Now, let me try to work through together with you, right, to see where these lines coming from. So we plot everything in logarithm plot. Again, it's hard to see this labeling there. But rather, I try to look at the crystal geometry that I tried to present you there. So we're going to rotate again in this plane. Now let's look at one family from this beta family. We look at this distribution where the minimum happens, and that guy where minimum happens. And we see that just by looking at the trend, we know it's coming from these planes. And how we know it's coming from these planes? Well, the minimum happens around 45 degrees. 45 degrees should be the normal of that surface. So that means this set of planes. Okay, so we are looking at this set of families. And how about the bigger planes? It's indeed coming from that. We look at this again, and you can see that this is where minimum happens for this particular one. It happens around 90 degrees, so that's coming from this end axis. The other one, the minimum happens around 180 degrees. That's coming from the top and bottom planes again. Okay, so this would be by tracking this, by working through this, I know the angular dependence of each one. And we're looking at the angular dependence and try to compare that with one over cosine angle. As indeed, we see it's going as one over cosine angle. And for the other one, the beta peak, we see it goes as one over cosine angle, right? Now, you can see the key difference. Minimum here is 0 and 90. Here is 45 and 135. As I try to emphasize, that means where the minimum happens. Oh, that's where the normal of that plane would be. So that's coming from where 45 or 135 is, or it's coming from 101 plane families. The other one coming from 09 to 180, that's coming from top bottom 100 planes. That's how we figure out where they're coming from. Of course, there are, well, that's saying that we should have different planes. From the calculation, you would expect two errors. Do we see that? Yes, well, you see that there's another alpha contribution there. And it's small value, so we have to build up some statistics. But basically, it's again following one over cosine angle dependence. So I believe that's coming from 100 plane. All right, so we see some signal coming from top and bottom planes. And do we expect anything coming from 101 planes? Well, simple idea would say yes. By projecting where the crossing happens to 101 planes, we're going to expect these kind of structures, and that one will be protected by temporal symmetry. That will not, unless there's mirror symmetry, and we just see these pockets. Oh, anyway, that's some theory. Okay. So we further rotate the sample, not just in that from A to C, from 100 to 001, right? We further did the study from the 100 to 011. In the sense, we are going from where the gamma pockets dominate to where other pockets dominate, to where beta dominant covers. And there's different projection of different planes. And the solid line is what we expect from the 2D surfaces. And there's the data, so that's what we see. And I see she has left, but I think we are crossing this 111 planes. And you would expect there may be some also one topological protected surface state, and this one pocket, exactly 111 planes. Maybe there's some features telling us that we have that plane, but unfortunately, for that particular sample, there's no clear facets for 111. So this may or may not be the signature of that topological surface state or 111. All right, good. So I'll probably skip this long level indexing plot. There's some analysis where we're taking the derivative and taking a filter and try to demonstrate basically for other pockets, we don't have to really extrapolate. It's indeed 1/2. But for the other larger pockets, the linear field tell us 1/2. But that's some detailed analysis. But I want to point out the open question. The open question tells us, well, it's a surface state, and we find a Fermi liquid theory explaining that very well. And in a sense, looking at the FFT amplitude, how big the oscillation pattern is, it follows the prediction of LK formula from what we learned about Fermi liquids. Okay. This is the effective mass plot, and this is the Dingle plot. So one tells us the mass, one tells us about the mean free path. And here are the parameters we're getting there. You may note that how small the mass is. 0.1 to 0.2. That's really strange, right? We're looking at potential heavy fermion compounds. We're looking at some mass really light.
No, the electrons are really wide.
That could be a solution, right? But it's just when we saw the data, it was striking to at least to us, surprising to us. But this is what we observe: a relatively light mass. But if that's unique to Semura Hexplorer or unique to this kind of growth, we should look at, right? We're not having a surface lines like this. With direct point in the center or in the middle gap, rather, it should be far away from the gap. By the way, the slope this way, I got that from Arcas. All right, so now, do we have any other evidence for the similar mass or heavier mass? That made us looking at floating zone growth samples. Flux growth samples with aluminum, there's always it's coming out of aluminum flux. So we etch them away, we etch aluminum away, and we do angular dependence, make sure we do not have any signal really coming from aluminum. But it's still, at least it's possible that this etching process, or even some left aluminum, may affect the effective mass. Maybe. We just do not know. Let's try to look at samples without aluminum flux and see what happens. So this is a compound from floating zone growth matter from McQueen's group, from Johns Hopkins. I believe probably Colin showed you the data last Friday, but basically we look at the IV plot, it's resistive, and looking at the resistance for the full temperature range up down to 20 millikelvin, we see a saturation, but probably below 200 millikelvin, not at 3 Kelvin, but at lower temperature. There's still saturation of resistance. And the value is still well below, at least order magnitude, a few orders magnitude below the quantum resistance. Okay, this is the resistance we see in the floating zone growth Semura Hexplorer. And this is one example of quantum oscillations, or at least the raw data we observe. Here is the magnetic torque, and we plot just as a comparison on our setup. And we see some wiggles happening around 30 Tesla. And that's the oscillatory torque by subtracting a polynomial background, and this is what we see, all these wiggles. And the Fourier analysis shown here, where we again observing some low frequency upper pockets, dominating feature are beta and gamma pockets, harmonics or beta, or some other gamma pockets coming from neighboring planes. I did not explain in detail, but imagine that we have this 90-degree wave facets, right? And each time we rotate, right, as long as the field is not exact along certain axis, we're going to have not one plane signal, but from other neighboring planes. And that's coming from neighboring planes. We also have harmonics of that. OK, so that's a pattern we see up to 3,000 Tesla. And above that, really, we do not have much signal there. And we are able, we're looking at frequency versus angle plot. Again, this is what we did, rotating from 100 planes and then to 011. So going from one family to the other family. In the middle, we're going to cross this 111 facet. So this is what we observe. There may be some features around 40, 55 where 111 happens, but it's not conclusive. But at least the planes coming from the, or the contributions coming from the beta or gamma pockets are predicted. And roughly speaking, it's consistent with what we observe. All right. So I think the most interesting part is following, right? We see some wiggles, quantum oscillations, coming from this kind of floating zone ground samples. And here I plot oscillation amplitude, or actually FFT amplitude, for the beta and the gamma pockets, beta and the gamma pockets there, against, actually I believe I labeled them reverse. This should be gamma. This should be gamma, this should be beta. But anyway, we find out that's what we see in temperature dependence. And that's consistent with a mass 1 or 1.2 ME. Before, for the aluminum flux ground samples, it's 0.1 to 0.2. Now this is order of magnitude change. Does that mean that now we're really looking at the heavier mass given from this surface condition? Maybe or maybe not, but at least this is our data. All right, let me conclude here. We have condo insulator, similar hexafluoride. I did not emphasize it, but it's a really good insulator, at least above 3 Kelvin. Resistivity increases by 5 orders of magnitude. And yet, we're able to observe quantum oscillations, and we demonstrate it follows one cause angle dependence. So it's at least, for this data set, it's a quasi-2D, or at least a two-dimensional electronic state. All right, with this, I want to thank you for your attention.
Talk and so the samples that that you get, can their shape be controlled? Are they cleaved? Are they cuts? How do you get them, and can you modify them from what's given to you?
That's a very good point. So I think question should be actually following, right? If you see some quantum oscillation, if you plot it and make the area larger or smaller, are we going to see the oscillating signal getting bigger or smaller, right? I think this is a wonderful question. That's something we need to do, or we are doing now. The concern, of course, we are not a grower. So we have to be careful about how much treatment we can do with that. At the same time, we modify the geometry. We should be careful about whether this is going to change the mobility. The signal size or quantum oscillation pattern is not just determined by how small or how large area is. It's also determined how much dingle scattering you have, or how good the midway pass would be. So I think a systematic study is needed by changing the area for serious studies. And we should model that with not only the area, but we also need to model that with the midway pass and see what's the underlying oscillation size, considering both. And that would actually help us to figure out exactly which planes give us dominating feature, right? Because I always give you, by the geometry, I tell you it's coming from parallel planes. Is that true? I don't know. This is argument from geometry, from the rotation. But it could well be that one is dominating against the other one, given the disorder on that surface.
So just a comment. So many floating zone crystals the growth direction, the direction along the long axis of the crystal can vary, and can vary quite a bit, actually.
Right.
And so it could be that your floating zone crystals would have quite different facets formed, because the facets will form normal to that direction.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I see. This is a really nice point. I'm really glad I learned from that. So the facets that the picture showed you, that's from flux, right? The floating zone sample, the piece that we gathered from Taran, from Josh Hodgman group, actually they polished two planes out for us. One is 100 and one is 011. And we that's actually why we rotated from that, because it's an irregular shape sample and we have two nice defined planes, so we can rotate the period in that. So at least the Lowry pattern shows it's a nice crystal and confirm the orientation of that two planes. But this is an interesting point. Do we know about the other sides?
Yeah, so there's some evidence that there might be ferromagnetism on the plane, right, on the surface.
Yes.
And that might open a gap for whatever direct fermions that you're seeing in thermal oscillations. So can you give a constraint on the gap, given that you found oscillations and you measure a Fermi vector?
This is a very good point. So first of all, I think the evidence for magnetic ordering happens below 100 millikelvin, and so far our data stays above 300 millikelvin. Second, whether we can give some estimation about the gap size. Unfortunately, it's hard. In the sense, we are looking at a one carrier density. We are not able to tune the gate, tune where the chem potential sits. So I have some measurement of parameters for parameters from the surface, but I cannot tune that chem potential to exactly where or near where the point is. So so let me think about how to estimate that. I think the most important part is, we did our many sample experiments down to 300 millikelvin, but what happens to 20 millikelvin, right? Are we going to see potential disorder? And would that affect the Fermi surface? I think that would be something really interesting to look at.
I have a question myself. So the resistivity versus temperature has a very clearly defined around one or 2K,
right.
This very steep outcome. So which is of the order of few Tesla?
Yes.
Energy. So
right.
How magnetic field
is just shrinking the gap.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, this is a good point. So I did not show the slides, but I believe this is coming from Corey's data. This is from Los Alamos group, where they're able to have a piece of Semera hexboron at 6 and 5, 4 Kelvin and push the field all the way up to 150 or 200 Tesla. This is one shot experiment. They show a very nice negative magneto resistance, which comes from condo behavior. And then it turns upwards around 120 to 150 Tesla, which their interpretation is at least 4 Kelvin, you need that magnetic field, 100 T or 200 T to kill that. So to suppress a gap at low temperature.
And magnetic, if you measure the magnetization, mm-hmm. as versus field, which you have done. So the oscillation starts around 5.
True, that's right.
Yes. So, and it's fully quadratic, which you would expect from the naive linear dependence.
Right.
So, why is this 5 piece kind of critical?
It's not critical, actually. Sorry. I present the very nice crystal and very nice data coming from Zach's crystal. So I have a range of samples coming from USDC and coming from Maryland, from JP. The sample quality actually matters a lot about where field app happens. In that particular sample, 5 Tesla is where it starts. But we're not always that lucky. For some samples, we need to go beyond 20 Tesla to observe quantum oscillation. So in that sense, the disorder in each level really matters a lot for us to observe quantum oscillation. Actually, I would love to see that samples always have oscillating stars at 5 Tesla so that we can do all the studies back in our own lab. Unfortunately, we do not have that.
I have a question on your two sets of samples, because one of the striking differences is these effective masses that you seem to measure. So now, can you say something about then the quality of the sample? So looking at these results, which set of samples would be for you or offer you the highest quality?
This is a very good point. Here we go. So there might be some striking difference if you just look at the resistance. So if you compare this resistance with what we had before, it turns out this is actually high resistance compared with before. So even though I see this is well below 25 kilo ohms, right? But we understand where that difference coming from. It's nothing but due to the model. For 2D electron gas, the conductance or resistance should be 25 kilo ohms over KFL. A KFL is what we can measure, roughly 50. So that translates to this range, 100 ohms. Right. So for the floating zone samples, what we find is unique, and I think this is well documented back to 80s, is there's a double plateau. There's something happening here, and there's something happening there. Well, I didn't plot in log-log plot, but imagine log-log plot, and it's showing there's some bending this way, and then bending the other way. So something different happens there. Which one has better quality? Judging by X-ray, I believe Tyron would say that this sample has better quality for the crystal structure. But again, this was done by different Gauss method. I believe flux method that I have presented most of the data there should form us a very nice domain out just because there are some flux helping there. This guy, you typically do that with melting, right? Melting and then grow that. Maybe some domain would form inside. But again, I'm not an expert for growth. I do not know exactly how to compare the quality there. I just learned from them.
Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Maybe you should ask me a follow-up.
So it seems like if you think about the field beyond which you begin to see quantum oscillations, that's set by omega c tau.
True.
Given that in the flux zone sample you saw it at 5 tesla, here you saw it only at 20 tesla, you might argue that one was the cleaner sample.
That's a clean sample coming from what? That's the issue, right? So it's a surface, right? That's how the work function on the surface, it's affecting the mass. If you affect the mass, it's going to affect the memory paths a lot. But is that intrinsic or not? We need further evidence to judge that. It's true that for some samples, we have 5 tesla showing oscillations. For some flux zone method samples, it's starting around 20. Here it starts around 30. So judging by omega tau value, I agree with you. But intrinsic or not intrinsic, at least mass, I know it's different.
And the frequency is the same, but the mass is different. That's also kind of weird.
Yeah. Frequency stays more or less the same. Mass is different. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
This is very different from bismuth selenide, actually. Bismuth selenide, the work function changes. You make the different area on the surface. And actual mass there stays more or less the same. That's different surface condition change the whole thing. So here, what we observe is frequency roughly stays the same, but the mass is different. So I did not talk about the Cambridge group, but if you look at the Cambridge data, the is also comparable to what we see here. This is 40, 50. It's the same range we look at. And there, some light mass and high temperature, something really dramatic, not even able to fit with ILK formula, but must be very, very heavy there. It's again same frequency for what we observe there, but mass is different.
But the breakdown in Lipschitz-Kosovich in the Cambridge data is at lower temperatures than any
true
data.
Lower. It's 120 millikelvin.
Yeah.
There could be two qualities, though. There could be a bulk quality and a surface quality, which could be different for both of them.
True. I agree.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you specific measurement which also give you effective mass for the surface?
Specific heat measurements?
Because you're present about what is effective mass, but if you look at a specific heat from the surface states.
Actually, I would be shocked that specific heat gonna give you any signal coming from the surface.
So again,
magnetization and heat capacity are both thermodynamic measurements, for sure, right? But magnetization, surface, or different thing can give you different contributions. Bulk, as I tried to argue that, even if it gives some small signal, because anisotropy is really small, the signal can be really small. I try to emphasize that, judging by signal size I'm having there. Mm-hmm. For the surface, it's reasonable. Ball magneton swing. But if indeed it happens for the bulk, it should be 10 to minus 6, 10 to minus 7 ball magneton swing. It's teeny tiny sample. Specific heat, no matter what, it dominates. It's really hard for me to imagine that there's some creative way to exclude the massive contribution coming from bulk. Given the typical geometry there, bulk dominates by order of million. So it measures the bulk. Uh-huh. Anything seen in specific heat, it should be the bulk signal.
And can you see the sigma x y of half for the surface state? I mean, if you apply,
can I see the quantum Hall effect from
surface? Yeah, it should be unusual quantum Hall at the surface, right?
Because
it's just a logical surface state and apply both electric and magnetic field.
This is a good point. We do not observe. As you can see, I showed very first slides, early slides. In our test, we put Corbinian ring there to measure a particular sample. The mobility is actually low. So here our mobility is in the order 1,000. Even for this kind of mobility,
it's not a fraction quantum Hall effect.
Okay, not even fraction quantum Hall effect.
Right.
So mobility is only in the order of 100 to 200 for the resistivity measurements. So because of that, we did not observe quantum oscillation yet. No, not even the quantum Hall effect. That's the reason why we are pushed to understand the surface condition, how that affects the mobility there, and so that we can have a reasonable field and try to look at oscillation. So one thing that we want to push to 100T, but 100T may kill the gap. So we need to find out a way to get a good surface quality and see if we can observe oscillations.
And can you change the thickness of your sample so that the surface states interact with each other or something like that, make it very thin?
That's a very...
Asking questions which are very true.
No, this is a question we should direct to Garors, right? Can you get good thin film? For such purpose. So I have been talking with many different girls. So far the reaction is negative because of Cenarion, because of boron. One melting point is 1,000 or 800. A boron melting point is 2,000 or 2,400. So it's quite challenging to make single crystalline film there. But if indeed there's a way to deposit that would be really neat to see what happens. Stay tuned for progress. I know this is not many body focus, many bodies interested with the bulk signal there.
I think it's right time to stop here. Thank you very much.